Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
The politics of immigration.
And we're looking at really all things immigration. It is certainly the issue of our time. It is the now moment. And indeed now, Jane Guskin and David L. Wilson, who have been writing since 1990 about immigration and labor and Latin America and the Caribbean, and are co-authors of The Politics of Immigration, a must-read and have book, join us to interrogate further this urgent subject that does define our time. And it's nice to have both of you with us.
Thank you for having us.
Ken.
I want to begin with not so much why you wrote the book, but the imperative and general thesis of the book politically for both of you. And the book was published by Monthly Review Press. And David, why don't you start us on that, and Jane?
Well, I think the most important thing for us right away was immigration is a huge and complicated issue. And it's an issue that touches many other things, international relations, labor law. People really don't understand it very well, and the media and the politicians have not done a good job of explaining it. So one of the most important things for us was simply to get the facts out and let people start to draw conclusions based on facts, not on mythology.
Jane?
Yeah, I would add also, to put a different perspective out there, a lot of times people use the facts to argue for policies that are really just not perhaps slightly less bad than the worst, but not really looking at things in a holistic way and not really sort of challenging the status quo. I mean, I think that's a big part of it. Things are framed in a certain way by the media, and then people tend to challenge only within that frame. So we wanted to break out of that a little bit.
But there's also a political perspective you have. So it's not just a point counterpoint. So let's get to the heart of what it is that you were trying to show about the issue of immigration as opposed to certainly the manipulation of the right, of the alt-right, of white nationalists. Your perspective on immigration that again led you to this book and the facts that are in it.
I would say the main thing is just to talk about how harmful enforcement is and how counterproductive enforcement is for the interests of regular working people in this country as well as regular working people who happen to be from other countries. So I think that's the main thing. I think a lot of people, especially now, a lot of people are saying, well, nobody's saying that we shouldn't have robust border enforcement and that we shouldn't have, fences and that we shouldn't have deportation. Like, nobody's saying that. Well, yeah, we are saying that.
Wait a minute. What do you mean you're saying that? What would Nancy Pelosi and what would Chuck Schumer say?
Well, what I would say to them is the border security that we have right now has killed between 7,000 and 8,000 people over the past 20 years. That is, we've cut off every easy way to get into the country and purposely forced people to travel through deserts and mountains. And, you know, just think about that number. It's about 400 a year at this point, even though very few people are even trying to get across the border now. If you compare that with the way we talked about the Berlin Wall, which the number of deaths was in the low hundreds, I mean, it's just...
Then that was take down the wall. Gorbachev, take down that wall. Tear down that wall. But there's so continue on that, both of you.
Yeah, the other thing to get across, which the media have been a little better about recently, is there was a large wave of unauthorized immigration across the border in the 80s and 90s and the first part of the 2000s. That was already tapering off before 2007. With the recession in 2007, it stopped. It stopped dead. It's like the rate of crossing the border is probably about what it was when Richard M. Nixon was president, and he wasn't concerned about it. He wasn't a bleeding heart liberal. So why is it an issue now?
Why is it an issue now, Jane?
Well, I mean, I think that people really like to rally nationalism to distract people from class issues. So I think that it really becomes an effective way to get people to say, you know, because, I mean, there's all kinds of sort of boundaries you could draw around yourself and your group, right? Your group could be your class, or your group could be your nation, or your group could be your family or your city. But so if they really try to get people to draw those lines around the national border, which they do with wars as well, right? So with wars and this sort of insistence on this imagery of an invasion, and that, you know, building a wall and all of these kinds of things, it's a distraction in a way. I mean, as David said, immigration coming across the border is way down, so it's really not an issue, but it's a useful distraction.
I mean, the very idea of calling it an emergency, calling for an emergency when it's at an all, you know, basically all, the majority of people in the country weren't born the last time border crossing was as low as it is now. How can that be an emergency?
You know, the way I've read, I haven't read your book yet, and I will, but I've read some articles and some reviews, and from what I think you're saying also is that the major harm is not the immigration itself. It's the enforcement of the immigration laws which prevent the immigrants from trying to get a better life here, and that it also tears away at minimum labor standards because immigrants really don't feel comfortable complaining. So the real problem, right, is the way the laws are enforced, not the immigration itself. Did I get that right?
Right. I think that's a really important point to emphasize. So it's the harm that the enforcement is doing. But it's not just the enforcement, it's the laws as well, right? The laws, these restrictive laws, and not just the laws, but the visa policy. So that's, you know, the reason why people from Western Europe can get on a flight and come to this country, and then if they want to overstay their visa, they overstay their visa, and often nobody notices. Compared with if you're coming from Mexico or from Central America, you're not going to get a visa. So the people coming from Western Europe, they don't even need to apply for a visa in advance. People coming from Mexico or Central America, if they apply for a visa, they get turned down. And that's hundreds of dollars wasted because they're never going to get a visa. And so they, if they're going to come here, they have to cross across the border illegally. And so that issue, first of all, a lot of people don't understand that. They don't understand that our visa policy discriminates based on national origin. And the effect of that is that you have people who are in a vulnerable situation here, who are stuck here without documents. The 2/3 of the undocumented immigrants in this country now have been here more than 10 years. And people don't have options. You know, a lot of times people will say, well, why don't they just do it the right way, or why don't they get legal? Well, there is no way for most of the people who are here to get legal. There's no way for them to get their documents and to have that stability and that security that would allow them to more easily stand up for their rights. Now, this is not to say that undocumented immigrants are not standing up for their rights, because many of them are, and they're doing it taking incredible risks because they are vulnerable to deportation, but they're fighting back, and that's a really important point as well. But it's a situation that really does depress labor standards. And then there's the fact that all of the money that's going to enforce immigration laws that's being increased over the years, while money enforcing labor laws, labor protections, health and safety protections, wage and hour protections, that money has been decreased. So there's less protection of workers at the same time that there's increased attacks on workers.
Well, one of the things I want to just get back to something David was saying before, which is shaping it a little differently than Ken did, which is because of the degree of enforcement on the border, people are dying. So it's not about whether or not we're enforcing our laws, etc., or have the opportunity to do that. It is the very nature of borders, which for me, and I'm on the record with this for sure, borders are really nothing more than artificial constructions for the opportunistic and exploitative purpose of the contemporary nation states, as far as I'm concerned. And do I believe in the abolition of borders? Yes, I do. However, I'm not running for office, which is probably a good thing at this juncture. But I do want to ask you why you think it's so easy. And looking maybe at the last election, where people who were not severely economically oppressed were able to be used by a mere whipping up of xenophobic hysteria, which populists like Trump have done historically in this country. Why is that such an easy thing to evoke xenophobic response to any group of people who may be coming into this country at a particular point of time in our history? Now, certainly, South and Central Americans, Mexicans, etc. What have you unearthed, and how do you understand that politically? Jane, David?
Well, I actually don't know the answer to that. maybe David does, but I mean, I've actually been
David's
trying
shaking
to figure
his
that
head.
Out. I'm trying to figure out, why that has so much appeal for people. I've gotten into some discussions with people who support the wall, and I'm really having a hard time grasping what it is, because it seems to be so irrational. And they just, it really comes down to it being sort of some kind of monument to, they talk a lot about it's the laws, but people break laws all the time. It's like only these particular laws that get that kind of reaction out of people, right? So it's not really about us being a nation of laws. That's not what it's about. So David, I don't know, thoughts?
Yes, I mean... the origins of racism and xenophobia, I'm not a philosopher who can speak to that, but certainly the situation now, a lot of it, when you talk to some people are really racist, you know, there's not much you can do about it, but a lot of other people, if you talk to them, you know, like construction workers in Queens, if you talk to them, it turns out that they really don't understand the situation. And a lot of that is on the media. It's on there's a systematic denial of what's going on. I guess the Vox immigration reporter, she has something with initials, which I can't remember. But basically, she says, Trump says over and over again, they're coming across the border to murder you. And people really believe that. You know, and if that's one of the reasons we feel it's really important to talk to people and get to the people who actually subscribe to xenophobic and racist ideas, but basically are doing it out of ignorance.
But what do you tell those construction workers then in Queens? I mean,
well, you tell them in the first place, you know, what evidence do you have that undocumented immigrants are killing you? And basically, you'll find out they only can give specific examples. The Libertarian Cato Institute managed to find the one state that actually keeps track of immigration status of people in prison, that people who are convicted, that undocumented immigrants are convicted of all crimes generally and of homicide, much less than native-born. And you have to allow for the fact that the undocumented immigrants are generally Latinos or they're of African origin. So they have a count against them already. They're more likely to be arrested. They're more likely to be convicted. And yet they still have a lower rate than the native-born people.
This country used to welcome immigrants. There were times when the only thing was, is the person carrying a disease which would spread or something, you check them out coming into the border, something of that nature. There were open borders for a long time along the Southwest, with people from Mexico coming into the country. This changed over time. Why was it okay then to promote immigration to this country? What changed it?
I guess I would have a very different take on that, but I'm curious about your answer because I don't think that we've ever been open to people of color or brown people or people coming in from Mexico. We took Mexico's land in a war, but open borders.
But the border was open at that time also.
Well, Jane,
so, can I say something?
Sure.
Yeah. So I think Ken raises an important point. So what you're talking about, Ken, is a sort of wave of immigration that came from Europe through Ellis Island, right? So why was that wave welcomed? Well, you know, I think part of that was, you know, the history of this country was built on racism. We know this, right? So, you know, the early immigrants from Europe, even before that time, were coming to basically take over land from the indigenous people and to create basically a European nation here. It was that sort of colonizer mentality, right? So, you know, the sort of pioneers and then send them out west and, you know, have them take over indigenous lands. So that mentality has shaped immigration law. Racism has shaped immigration law from the beginning. And
yeah.
I think that's really the biggest part of it, you know?
I think when you go to Ellis Island, by the way, there's nothing that's more clear than that. And no, the borders have never been open to people of color. They've never been open to Mexico. That's not the history of this country. I think it's critical to say that. And even when it came to the issue of Europeans, you know, it was a little piece that was just written in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago about how Anne Frank, her father had written to try to get her and numbers of other children admitted to this country during the advent of National Socialism and was unable to do that. So the issue of immigration has been primarily one of expediency and needs within the workforce. And I'm just interested whether you find that and has always been tinged with racism. When you go to Ellis Island, even now, you will see some vague plaques and letters about the exclusion historically of people from the West Indies, people from Africa, etc., in the context of the entries into Ellis Island, which were almost all people from European culture.
Right. Well, one thing that I think, you know, I was saying that racism has shaped our immigration law and policy from the beginning. One thing we did in the book is we have a chronology at the end that goes sort of through all the major laws and some of the major Supreme Court cases. And in creating that, it just became so clear to us, you know, all these things, you know, they would make a law that would restrict one group, and then it would turn out, you know, things changed, and then it wasn't restricting enough of the people they wanted to restrict, and so they would change it again, then change it over and over again. So, for example, the diversity visa that we have now, the visa lottery, people call it, that was created to basically, again, out of racism. They wanted to get more Europeans in. They wanted to get those people from Sweden or Norway, right? I mean, everything that they've done has been trying to restrict it on a racial basis. Now, that said, the Mexican border, there wasn't the restrictions that we think of now. There were restrictions based on class. If you were coming from the southern border or coming across the southern border on a first-class train ticket, you were able to come in and there were no restrictions. But if you were not with a first-class train ticket, then there was a sort of series of humiliations that people were subjected to, including being sort of fumigated, stripped naked, and sprayed with, you know, pesticides and various kinds of things. So, you know, the law allowed people to come from Latin America without restrictions for a time, but it wasn't truly free passage across the border.
I would say something else, that there has been a change after 1965 when immigration from the from this hemisphere was limited. I think that the way the way our rulers have used prejudice against the immigrants of whatever background to exploit their labor, that has become systematized in a way that it wasn't done before. In other words, starting at that point, we created, I believe Aviva Chomsky calls this the creation of illegality, that we didn't have that category before. It was true, Chinese and Asians generally were excluded, but there wasn't a large population of so-called illegal people. In other words, now we have this big population of, 10 or 11 million people who are basically human beings in our society who don't have rights, who can be exploited any way you want. And that is a creation since I personally feel that that's reaction to, the labor victories of the 1930s and the continuing the labor upsurge that you had around in the 60s and, the beginning of you look at the beginning of that period, you had all of these strikes. The postal workers went on strike. The GM workers were on strike. All of this was happening. And at this point, they discovered, when immigrants come in, let's make them into this subservient class without rights.
I saw Ken's eyes light up. We've certainly spoken a lot about that. And Jane, maybe you can talk a bit more about that. And David, that whole idea, of course, of regulating immigration based on the particular needs of the workforce at any one time, or for that matter, in response to a workforce that was unionizing or fighting much more aggressively for better working conditions, better wages, and so on.
Yeah, well, one thing I want to say is that with all of the discussion, with Trump going on and on about how we have to stop these people from coming and supposedly taking our jobs, at the same time, the same government and the same Trump, Trump himself uses guest workers, and the same government is pushing guest worker programs. They've expanded guest worker programs. The guest worker program now as a percentage of the agricultural workforce is about the same rate as it was with the Bracero program in the 1950s. But what this is treated as an immigration question, but it's not an immigration question, because what we're talking about is bringing people in, and then, as Trump said, they get out. We use them, we use their labor, and then we push them out. And that's a good way of keeping them from having a stable environment where they can organize, where they can organize unions. It keeps them from having a chance of becoming citizens, where later on they can vote and agitate and do things to improve the situation.
And they're tied to one employer in most cases.
And they're almost always tied to one employer. There's ideas that will improve that and make it a little easier. But in fact, if you look, the laws are really designed to exploit guest workers. And it's, they're not really going to make, if you take that away, they're not going to want the laws. But certainly
right.
by
and
blocking the border is one of the great ways to force people into guest worker programs.
And they used that actually specifically with the Bracero program. They went through these sort of deportations and had these crackdowns on the border specifically to force people to come back through the Bracero program. And so, they're still, those two things go hand in hand, right? The tough restrictions on the border and the guest worker programs. And the guest worker programs, there are guest workers who have organized and who have fought back. And the problem is, when they do that, they get put on the next plane home. They have, even when they're technically protected by certain labor rights, they don't have the right to be here, and so then they get put on the next plane and shipped back, and, they lose their opportunities. So guest workers are, I would say, at least as vulnerable, if not more vulnerable, than undocumented workers are when it comes to defending their workplace rights. And yet, people have still fought back and organized. You can't stop people from fighting for their rights.
And the time goes too quickly, and in the very few minutes that we have left, David, Jane, what can people do? how can they help support immigrant rights? One thing is to get your book and use it, which really is a primer on things like why don't people, quote unquote, come here the right way, and why should we let people come in? And the people, you know, who oppose the wall, what is it that they need to be able to say to convince others that the machinations of Trump are thoroughly concocted and wrong-headed? So your major thoughts on that, Jane, and we'll wind up with David, and we'll wind up with, most seriously, again, telling people that they need to get a copy of The Politics of Immigration.
Thank you, Mimi. So what people can do is really, there's a lot of things people can do. People can support groups that are organizing, any groups that are really organizing in defense of human rights, workers' rights, immigrant rights. But there are, for sure, lots of groups doing immigrant rights work who need support and solidarity, and that's really important. Not everybody feels inclined to have these kinds of conversations with people who are, you know, wall supporters or whatever. But if you have the inclination, our book gives you all the tools that you need to get into those conversations, whether that's in person, whether it's in the comment section of an article, whether it's on social media. Have those conversations if you have the stomach for it. And if you don't, you know, other people can do it, and we do these dialogues, and we love to get into these participatory dialogues, and we're available to do that, to share the model. If other people want to use our book for that, we encourage that. So, let's get out there and have those conversations, because I think it was what David said was important, that there are a lot of people who really just don't understand the situation, and if they understand it, then they realize that their own interests are being harmed by the current policy, and we really need to make sure that people understand it's not just about Trump and the sort of in-your-face anti-immigrant stuff that's happening now, but the policy for many years and decades has been very harmful, and we can't just go back to how things were under Obama or anyone previous, because there is a lot of deportations and a lot of harm being done.
And we have about 45 seconds, David Wilson.
Well, I don't need 45 seconds. I just want to say, if you want to contact us, if you want to stay in touch with us, you can go to The Politics of Immigration. That's one word, thepoliticsofimmigration.org. And from there, you can find out how to email us. You can find out how to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And yes, we're available. We do our best to talk to people and to try to get the dialogue going on these issues.
And as you can see, even here, there are shades of difference and concerns that need to be fleshed out. And I want to thank Jane Guskin and David Wilson for leading Ken and I in somewhat of a dialogue, because we have miles to go before we sleep. There's so much involved in the politics of immigration and what we have to learn and what we have to understand historically, as well as how things are used contemporaneously for the issues of the labor force, for people's various political machinations. So again, Jane Guskin, David Wilson, The Politics of Immigration. It is a wonderful and important discussion that you let us in tonight.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thanks.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.